You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 23rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Isabel Charlet, Eric Tegadoff, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, Trump's tenure begins with lawlessness. Although we were all alerted as to what Donald Trump would do in his first days in office, it's still shocking when he does it. He has issued a clearly illegal and unconstitutional executive order that disregards the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and is racist to boot, eliminating citizenship by birth in the case of babies born to parents in the U.S. illegally. His transition team says the U.S. will not grant asylum to people crossing the border illegally, in plain violation of international law that calls for asylum for people who have a reasonable fear of persecution. His plan to issue a declaration of national emergency at the Mexico border is a political stunt. Illegal border crossings are way down, at levels below the final months of Trump's first term, the New York Times reports. Trump said in his inaugural address that he wants to expand our territory, which translates to a new imperialism directed at Greenland and perhaps Panama. Then there are the blanket pardons of the January 6 insurrectionists, overturning some 1,500 convictions and incidentally justifying Trump's incitement of the insurrection. The pardon will release the leaders of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And finally, there's Trump's plan for a blanket firing of civil servants, which is already being challenged in court. Quite an agenda for our first felon-in-chief. Enough to prompt President Biden in his final hours in office to grant preemptive pardons to five members of his family, as well as to Liz Cheney, Anthony Fauci, General Mark Milley, and all the members of the January 6th House Committee, their staff, and the police officers who testified. Because, as the president said, the rule of law is not enough to protect people from Trump's promise of retribution. Thailand buckles and is ready to send Uyghurs back to China. In a letter to Thailand's prime minister and other officials in January, a large number of researchers urged the release and resettlement of 48 Uyghur refugees who have been detained in Thailand for more than 11 years and are now being readied for forcible return to China. That action would be contrary to the Convention Against Torture that Thailand has ratified. According to an article in the Associated Press, the men were asked to sign consent forms to return to China and refused. All 48 of the Uyghurs detained in Thailand have applied for asylum to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. A UN allegation letter of February 28, 2024, noted that many of its concerns about the conditions of detention had not been addressed. The National Human Rights Commission of Thailand, moreover, investigated two Uyghur deaths within the detention facilities and called for the group to be released and resettled as their detention is against international law. The group of Uyghurs detained was originally much larger, over 350 men, women, and children, who were detained in 2014. 172 women and children were sent to Turkey, and 109 or more were forcibly returned to China. That left 53 Uyghurs in Thai immigration detention. Five have since died, including two children. There has been no news of these 109 Uyghurs since they were sent back to China, and their well-being is not known. The principle of non-refoulement guarantees that a person cannot be returned to a country where they would face torture, cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment, or punishment and other irreparable harm. Ongoing concerns regarding Uyghur repression in the region include sterilizations, cultural assimilation, arbitrary prison sentencing, and forced labor. Thailand has not, so far as I'm aware, made a final decision on the Uyghurs. No doubt the pressure from China is intense, but pressure is also mounting from the international community. Next, China is evaluating what economic growth means. An article in the official People's Daily at the end of last year seems to reflect an official rethinking of what economic growth means. Though for years Chinese and Western economists were all devoted to gross domestic product, GDP, now the official line is that, quote, high quality development, not speed, is the new order. The article in People's Daily says, quote, when looking at economic growth rate, we must not only look at the present or the immediate moment, but more importantly, look dialectically and long term. Valuing speed, but not being solely focused on speed, is the dialectical approach currently followed by China's economic development. GDP and its growth rate are typically used to measure a comprehensive economic strength and level of an economic entity. However, as a quantitative indicator, GDP emphasizes the concept of quantity and cannot comprehensively reflect the quality and efficiency of economic activities. General Secretary Xi Jinping pointed out, understanding economic development as simply an increase or decrease in quantity and simple repetition is a metaphysical view of development. Since the 1960s, among more than 100 middle-income economies globally, only a dozen have successfully become high-income economies. The ones who were successful have achieved a shift in economic development from quantitative expansion to qualitative improvement after experiencing a period of high-speed growth. Those countries that have stagnated or even regressed have not achieved this fundamental transformation. The extensive economic development model once played a significant role in our country, but also made us pay enormous resource and environmental costs, concealing some contradictions and risks. The article goes on to say that achieving a particular growth rate is not essential, saying, quote, this year's annual economic growth target is around 5%, and we have been striving toward this goal. Through effort, whether it's slightly left or right of 5% is acceptable. In other news, China creates a propaganda center in Xinjiang. The China Media Project reports that in recent years, the Chinese government has sought to centralize news and information for the benefit of foreign media. This effort takes place in international communication centers established in just about every province. All local media become part of these centers. We can see the real purpose of these centers by looking at the newest one in Xinjiang, where China's genocidal policies when dealing with the Uyghur population have spawned an effort, according to the center there, to, quote, tell the story of Xinjiang in the new era well, in many forms and through many channels in international society, unquote. In short, rebrand the Xinjiang story as one of social progress for ethnic minorities. Besides distributing uplifting videos and news reports, Xinjiang also hosted a World Media Summit in Urumqi, the capital. Executives from Reuters, AP, and CNN rubbed elbows with their counterparts at Xinhua, People's Daily, and China Media Group. Xinjiang's party secretary expressed hope that delegates would, quote, adhere to journalistic ethics, objectively report and record Xinjiang, consciously resist false information, oppose rumors and prejudices, and tell the international community about the real Xinjiang. Actually, these Western media largely have done just that, and it's precisely for that reason that Chinese policies in Xinjiang have been called crimes against humanity by the United Nations. TikTok is far from gone. The Supreme Court's unanimous decision that ByteDance, Chinese owner of the TikTok app, must either find a buyer or cease operations in the U.S., is interesting for its narrowness. The court did not buy the argument that TikTok has violated free speech, nor that it is propaganda that might persuade Americans to support the Chinese Communist Party line. Instead, the court only accepted the government's national security case, namely that TikTok is accumulating data on Americans that could threaten U.S. security. Personally, I find that argument also not persuasive, but there it is. Now Donald Trump, formerly an ardent opponent of TikTok, and now its benefactor, has granted TikTok a stay of execution by executive order. As I have pointed out before, it will be to favor a millionaire supporter and not to support free speech. TikTok will survive. Did you see the photo of TikTok CEO sitting beside Tulsi Gabbard at Trump's inauguration? And Trump said at a rally preceding the inauguration, quote, "Frankly, we have no choice. We have to save it." Cable cutting in the Baltic Sea escalates. Norway's electrical supply is delivered by cables beneath the Baltic Sea. As the leading country in energy conservation and reliance on renewable sources of energy, Norway's economy and communication systems can be especially vulnerable if those cables, which connect to oil and gas platforms on land, are cut. Over the last 2 years, a number of sabotage incidents have occurred, disrupting the cables. NATO countries have said that Russian and Chinese ships are the likely source of the disruptions. Russia can draw on a large so-called shadow fleet that can drag anchors along the ocean floor, making it difficult to identify as a Russian government-designed operation. One other reason for suspicion of Russia is that Norway, now a NATO member, has become Europe's main alternative to reliance on Russian oil and gas. Norway is the biggest supplier of natural gas to Europe and the largest energy supplier to Britain. NATO patrols of the Baltic Sea have increased in response to the cable cutting, just recently including 3 Swedish warships. Next, the climate crisis may be driving Trump's territorial ambitions. Oscar Millman, a writer for The Guardian, points to a new theory for why Donald Trump wants to acquire Greenland and the Panama Canal for the United States. In each case, climate change is making those territories more important. Greenland is losing its ice cover at a phenomenal rate, making drilling to access its presumed mineral wealth easier. That was Don Trump Jr.'s point when he visited Greenland. Strategically, Greenland is considered more valuable now that Russia and China are focused on building assets in the Arctic Circle. Ocean transit can now be more frequent as icebound conditions lessen. That lessens also the value of the Panama Canal area, which is in the midst of a drought that has reduced water to the canal. Traffic through the canal is down, but denying its use to China and other adversaries still makes it a tempting target. Or so the theory goes. Students lead a pro-democracy movement in Bangladesh. An unusual combination of students and technocrats in Bangladesh have united to overthrow Sheikh Hasina, who had ruled for 15 years with increasing brutality. The students are intent on building a democracy. One student organizer says, quote, "Our political power is in a very fluid form right now. We want a country that is stable and will progress." The students couldn't have a better person to lead the transition. Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Prize winner, long acknowledged as the inspiration for microfinancing economic development and empowering women. Yunus has taken an unusual approach to reform. He has set up 6 commissions that must come up with recommendations on overhauling institutions such as the police and the judiciary, as well as on reducing corruption and improving public administration. The commissions are composed of experts from academia, government, and civil society, not political parties. This is an experiment in governance well worth watching. The last man in an Amazon rainforest dies. A man known as Tanaru, who had lived alone in Rondônia State, Brazil, uncontacted by the outside world, has died. He was the last of his indigenous group and had resisted contact for over 25 years while the Amazon forest around him was being devastated. Now there is a contention over ownership of the roughly 20,000 acres of rainforest Tanaro effectively presided over. Since he's the last of his people, should the land still be under state protection, or can it be privatized and subject to deforestation? One leader in the battle to protect the area says that it would be a measure of reparation for the murderous destruction of an indigenous population, rather than to permit a living people to thrive. Most Americans fail the citizenship test. A national survey by the Institute for Citizens and Scholars in Princeton, New Jersey, found that only 1 in 3 people could pass the multiple choice test. Quote, only 13% of those surveyed knew when the U.S. Constitution was ratified, even on a multiple choice exam similar to the citizenship exam, with most incorrectly thinking it occurred in 1776. More than half of respondents, that is to say 60%, didn't know which countries the U.S. fought in World War II. And despite the recent media spotlight on the U.S. Supreme Court, 57% of those surveyed did not know how many justices actually serve on the nation's highest court. The survey found that age was a significant factor. The participants over 65 fared best, under 45 the worst. And by state, Oregon fared poorly, with 60% of participants failing the test. Vermonters did best. Finally, an update from South Korea, whose president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has now been formally arrested for promoting an insurrection. We now learn that in his self-coup, Yoon ordered the arrest of leaders of both major parties, as well as deployment of troops to the National Assembly building. If Yoon is indicted, a constitutional court will have 180 days to consider whether or not to remove him from office. He is currently suspended from office, replaced by an interim president. If Yoon is removed, a presidential election will be held within 2 months. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, Portland City Councilors held a work session where they heard about Portland Mayor Keith Wilson's plan to end unsheltered homelessness. It involves opening emergency overnight shelters, scaling up until December of 2025. What follows is an excerpt from his presentation and from the councilor's response.
We face a crisis that can be overwhelming. Too many of our neighbors are sleeping and suffering on our streets. Heroic work has already gone into helping thousands of unsheltered neighbors. That work is vital and must continue. What I want to talk about today is a plan to solve the crisis and relieve the suffering we all see on the street every day. And when we work together to do that, we will make our existing programs to reduce homelessness even more effective. I believe we can solve this crisis and help our suffering neighbors. And by doing so, we can help Portland recover. Today, I want to tell you how we're going to work together. We must change the way we think about the crisis and respond immediately and decisively. Compassionately revitalizing our community begins with sheltering our unsheltered. We must prioritize emergency shelters first and then move on to day centers and solutions like Built for Zero. We're not building from scratch. We'll use what has worked in the past, both in Portland and our peer cities. Emergency nighttime shelters are important, but they're not intended to provide a comprehensive solution to the humanitarian tragedy on our streets. We'll use emergency shelters because we must treat the crisis like a crisis, and we'll respond with a full disaster recovery strategy to compassionately and cost-effectively shelter our unhoused population, and we'll end public camping and once again enforce basic norms of safety and sanitation. It's a necessary step to repair, restore, and revitalize the quality of life, livability, and the dignity for every Portlander, both the housed and the unhoused. What is missing? Emergency night shelters. So here's a blueprint on how Portland must respond to this crisis. In 2017, we changed our sheltering guidelines. We need to modify, and we must go back to and improve and increase and stand up a network of nighttime emergency shelters. In addition, we must make changes to our 24-hour shelters as they are, reintroduce 90-day stay limits, require engagement with case managers, and follow bed utilization rules. where we make sure every bed, every night is being used for life-saving care and never empty. Cost-effective, scalable emergency night shelters are not a replacement to other housing programs. Project Turnkey, Safe Rest Villages, temporary alternative shelters, 24-hour supportive shelters, and supportive housing all have a critical role to play. Emergency shelters provide a no-wrong door, first step for those who are ready to move off the streets, and a safeguard for those who slip through the cracks of our complementary programs. They're also a cost-effective pressure valve that frees up resources to help the rest of the system function. Low-barrier nighttime emergency shelters should be a trauma-informed space that provide nighttime housing using existing facilities such as community centers and businesses and churches. They can work for those with mental illness, addiction, or physical disability. They ensure guests are rested and ready for the next day, which for many include their next working day, their next work shift, or a positive step towards permanent housing or an opportunity to gain behavior health or addiction referral at a day center. And I'm happy to say the response from neighborhoods and businesses, nonprofit, and the faith community have been overwhelming. It's so much more than I dared to hope. Businesses have come forward with lists of 40 locations to add to our existing list of 30. 50 nonprofit homeless service providers attended a listening session to find out what they need to set up these shelter beds rapidly. There are unsheltered people who are ready right now. They're ready for shelter, for addiction and mental health services, and to be reunited with those who love them. It's time to turn to them and say, and Portland is ready too. We must raise the lowest level of the housing ladder from destitution on the street to a warm, safe bed for every Portlander every night. Nighttime emergency shelters are staffed with professionals, volunteers, and people with lived experience. Homeless service providers work to ensure a safe and welcoming environment with a focus on a safe night's sleep. Building owners are compensated for the use of their space. All adults are welcome, but minors and families with children are handled as part of a separate system. Sobriety is not required, but drugs, alcohol, and weapons are not allowed. They are cost-effective. Nighttime emergency shelters utilize existing facilities, eliminating construction and capital costs. In comparison, a transitional alternative shelter costs millions while providing fewer beds. In addition to low upfront costs, nighttime emergency shelters are far cheaper to maintain. They're scalable. The most important benefit of a nighttime emergency shelter is that they're quick to set up. By utilizing existing buildings, nighttime emergency shelters can often begin serving our community in days. In addition to being quick to set up, they can be closed just as easily when needs change. We enforce stay limits. Stay limits encourage guests to engage with services and move from emergency shelters to permanent housing. Without this rule, there's often little incentive for an individual to address their root cause of homelessness. They're generally near transit corridors to provide easy access for staff, volunteers, and guests. And they are complemented with day centers. Day centers are supportive, trauma-informed facilities that serve as a warm handoff from the nighttime emergency shelter. They link a person to a comprehensive network of services. Services can include meals and showers, clean clothes, storage, transportation vouchers, mental health services, addiction services, family reunification, and a path to permanent housing.
Councilor Smith.
Mr. Mayor, we're going into 2526. We were just given a letter saying that we have a $100 million hole. We are now producing $75 million worth of housing that should be paid for out of the joint office. How do you expect us to be able to afford this for 2526, to add an additional $75 million on top of our current budget?
Yeah.
And to propose it, you have some idea, I assume, because you have to drop the original budget, of where you're going to take $75 million away to be able to pay for this as we go.
You bet. So the first and foremost is to not focus on the Portland budget, but Sky and I are always going through a funding exercise. We have like 11 different buckets that we're going after first. So it's always, what can we use externally? What relationships do we have to go after? And that's why I'm meeting with so many people around the state and federally as well. But then I want to tackle this from a different direction, Counselor, as well.
Okay.
We can't afford not to do this. We're spending $27 million just on camp removals, $2,000 per warrant for an unsheltered person, and we get nothing out of that. The county, the judges, they're like $10 million in costs, and most of these individuals are FDAs. They failure to appear. Then they get arrested, and I've heard it's up to 50% of the arrests our officers are making are of the unsheltered. On the counter side of that, if you have basic nighttime shelter provided to somebody, it's only 2%. Our public safety system is imperiled because we aren't caring for our least or our most vulnerable. And the costs just keep adding up.
Counselor Murillo.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say thank you guys so much for being here and for all your hard work that you've put into this. I know it's been a lot of hours and research, and I've seen you here at all hours of the day, Mayor, so I appreciate you very much. I want to start off with some 101 reset for a few of the things that I heard, not from panelists, but just overall in the conversation. And I think that we've been conflating like safe rest villages and 24-hour shelters and some of our other supportive services. These are not housing. They are purely emergency shelters, including the safe rest villages, including the ones that are tiny homes with doors you can lock. Those are still not housing. They are emergency shelters. And I wanna reaffirm that because we need to make sure that when we're thinking about getting people into housing long-term, that we have a finer point on that. I also can't help but look at these budget numbers, and I really appreciated everything you said, Councillor Smith, as well, looking into that budget aspect of it. But I did some back of the napkin math, and I'm not a math girl, okay? So bear with me, but it looks like it costs about $102 a day to house someone in a 24-hour shelter. That's about $3,000 per month. It also costs about $189 a day to house someone in a safe rest village. That's about $5,800 per month. And it costs around $1,700 for an average one bedroom apartment in Portland. We don't seem to really have the numbers for parsing out what type of unhoused person we are helping, right? So you have some people that are gonna need a lot of supportive services. They have mental health, they have addiction, maybe they have some physical disabilities as well that make it difficult to have employment. But there's also people that were like me when they were unhoused due to some circumstances outside of their control. You know, I never suffered addiction issues. I was in college, I was studying, I was making $11-ish an hour working minimum wage while in school. And it simply was not enough to save up for a deposit, right? So I was really at the mercy of my community at that point, if it means to get out of that. So I'm looking at these numbers though, and I think that there are probably a lot more unhoused people that were like me who just needed a place to live than people who need a bunch of supportive services. And the cost of these shelters are extremely high, given that we could afford, paying for housing is what I'm kind of seeing here. And then on top of that, I think you brought up that sweeps are costing us about $27 million annually as well. So I just want to ground us in the cost of that per day and per month of what we're looking at and what our different options are for the future. I'm going to stop there from my comments, but I think that there are also a lot of assumptions made about the services offered. For example, not everyone has a safe home to return to. I did not have a safe home to return to, so it would not have been possible to return with my family were I offered a bus ticket or another option like that. Not everyone needs shelter services, they just need money. And I also just don't hear us asking a lot of unhoused people why they don't want to go into our shelters in the first place. And I'm becoming increasingly frustrated by that pattern in these meetings because we say we're gonna set up these shelters. We say that there are a lot of people that are rejecting going into our shelters, and we're not really asking why or how we're going to change these shelter systems so that people will want to actually voluntarily go in. And so I'm hearing contradictory things too, because you're saying we're not going to force people in, but there's a large portion of them that don't want to go, and we're going to have to push them in somehow. And Councillor Novick, I firmly reject this, love you, bro, but firmly reject the idea that we're going to use our police to force unhoused people into shelter systems. I think that would be an increasingly dangerous escalation. I think that's going to impact Black and brown unhoused people far more than anyone else. So I do appreciate that you have stated some of that, but I think I've also, you know, I read the presentation. I saw some of the stuff about ending the 72-hour notice, ending the 90-day, or instituting a 90-day stay limit. And some of these things I just think are not going to help people get back on their feet in the long term. A 90-day stay limit is simply not long enough for most people to get back on their feet. I was very lucky when I was unhoused that a family took me in and they didn't put any limits for how long I stayed there. And because they allowed me to live with them for 2 years, I was able to actually graduate college, and now I get to be on city council. That is not the story for most people. And for the times that I had stayed with people where it was for a month at a time or something like that, that is not stable enough to actually save up money or to do anything to get back into long-term housing. So I have a lot of concerns about some of the limits that were laid out here and the cost. It just doesn't make sense to me why we would spend this much money on 24-hour shelters when we could be putting people into permanent housing.
And you know, you talked about the high cost of 24-hour congregate shelter. Not only is it high cost, it takes 12 to 36 months to build, and that's the short-sighted time. So even if we wanted to try and build our way out of this, it'd still take 12, 36 months, and that's just if we're setting up a safe rest village. If we're gonna build a four-walled facility, it's gonna take 5 to 10 years and cost $27 million if it's a 300-person unit. So you're right, those are difficult. Hence, that's why I brought forward this crisis approach where we know we have thousands of people on the street, and we know many of them want to receive care tonight. Regarding stay limits,